First, it's time for our weekly check-in with Daniel Howes, business columnist at the Detroit News. And if you're saying, hey, this isn't Thursday, is it? Which is our regular day to talk with Daniel, you are correct. Tomorrow afternoon at 3, Michigan Radio will present a special State of Opportunity call-in program looking at school funding and inequality. So we're talking with Daniel today. And on the front burner, the mediation talks between Detroit's emergency manager Kevin Orr and dozens of lawyers representing the city's creditors. So the mediation opened yesterday, Daniel. Tell us exactly what's happening here.
Well, what it means is this is a kind of an innovative approach, as some bankruptcy lawyers have described to me, of having Judge Rhodes tap the ranking federal judge in the Eastern District, Gerald Rosen, to head up a team of mediators. And he's bringing in mediators from around the country, one's from Portland, Oregon, and another's from Denver, I believe, and Victoria Roberts from around here, David Corr of Illinois, and among others. And they have been assigned to various pieces of this very large dispute between the city and their creditors. And in part, I think, as one person described to me, this is an example or a chance for people to, as he said to me, try out their arguments on people who wear black robes, essentially to get a sounding of how the argument of why they should be paid more from the city than they're being offered, et cetera, whether it carries a lot of weight in this context or whether it doesn't maybe carry as much weight as they think. So it's kind of like a trial run, and this is being hailed as a rather innovative approach on the part of Judge Rhodes to try and streamline this process a little bit, because it is kind of a hydra-headed monster. You've got a lot of different pieces out here.
You're literally talking dozens and dozens of creditors and their lawyers. So basically, one might see this in part as a dress rehearsal for the eventual bankruptcy trial before Judge Rhodes. And it's also, there's hopes that something might get ironed out, right?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, I don't think there may be some dispute. There's clearly some dispute about over eligibility. I don't think there's a lot of dispute of the fact that Detroit doesn't have a lot of money, you know, that it's insolvent. I'm sure there will be people that will argue that. But in general, I think its financial condition is fairly well recognized. And it's something that's been in a downward spiral for decades. And it's really accelerated in the last, you know, 5 or so years. So I don't think that's really in dispute. But yes, I mean, this is an attempt for him to speed this process along. He has continued his eligibility hearings, which were scheduled to be this week, and they've been rescheduled and pushed off into the latter half of October to give all sides more time to prepare their arguments, conduct some depositions, as we've talked about in the past, and also to see if this mediation process starts to yield any kind of fruit.
Federal Judge Gerald Rosen opened the mediation Tuesday with quite the pep talk. What was he saying to all sides?
He was essentially saying, I think, that continued litigation is not going to be helpful to anyone. It's expensive. He used the word horrendous. It would be horrendous. It would be horrendous for the city. The longer that Detroit stays in bankruptcy, the harder it's going to be to get out. I think a lot of people believe the more expensive it's going to be for all parties, from the city to anybody who's hiring these lawyers. One of my colleagues said to me yesterday that he thinks that over 100 lawyers have now been accredited or enabled to be able to appear in court as part of this process. This is just huge, far larger. I think we talked about this before. One of the California bankruptcies, there were 12 or 13 objections to eligibility. In the Detroit case, it's over 100.
Wow. You know, one has to wonder, first of all, what's the most optimistic outcome you might envision? And then I'll follow up with something after that.
Well, I think the most optimistic might be that some of these mediations actually result in a deal, that they can be put before the judge and have him rule on them. That would be the most optimistic. And some of these, if you look down the list, some of these seem to be a lot less large, I should say. I don't want to say they're small, but less large than others. I mean, of course, you've got one that's dealing with retirees. You've got another one that's dealing with pensions. You've got another one that's dealing with this very complicated debt issuance in what's called the COPS, the Certificates of Participation, as they pertain to the pensions. And then you've got small ones, like one that is being mediated for the Detroit Economic Development Corporation, Economic Growth Corporation, that's owed like $36 million from the city and wants its money. But it's really the city's economic development arm. So in that sense, it's probably a little bit of a smaller kind of fish, but that amount of money is not insignificant to the DEGC.
Well, now here's the follow-up question. What do you realistically expect to happen, especially based on what's been said and the kind of posturing we've seen by both sides since Kevin Orr came to town and since the Chapter 9 filing?
Well, I think a lot of these people are posturing because they have to posture. This is a precedent-setting case. Whether it's pension funds or it's the public sector unions, or it's some of the financial creditors. You know, in a lot of cases, and I think we've expected this part for a long time, prior to the bankruptcy filing, that a lot of these interest groups were not going to settle with the city because they didn't want to set a precedent that could be emulated elsewhere around the country. You know, so I think there's a possibility that they are able to get some kinds of deals through mediation, but ultimately I think for some of these that are particularly symbolic, they may be in a position where they're going to have to go into court and they're going to have to go through the process and have the court be the bad guy, so to speak, and rule and split the baby however many different ways they're going to have to do it.
Very Solomon-like. The idea of bringing in judges from around the country strikes me as what a great idea. Fresh, impartial eyes and ears.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think for some people, like this judge from Portland who was taken on a tour, I think she was horrified at what she saw. You got to realize that a lot of people who we have lived and worked in this community for many years and have know the good parts, the bad parts, understand the complexities of why Detroit is where it is. A lot of people on the outside who've never really spent any time here, never really bothered to read much about it, when they come and see some of the stuff, it's very shocking. And, you know, I've spent time over the years in the context of the auto bailouts and the auto bankruptcies when reporters would come in from Europe and they'd want to sit down and talk, and then we'd go on a tour. They couldn't believe what they were seeing in some parts of town. And so, yeah, I think you do bring the fresh eyes, but you also bring somebody for whom this is all very, very new, and I think they can be motivated to push the parties to a resolution.
Well, we will be watching, and so is the nation. Obviously, when you consider it's the largest public bankruptcy in American history, they are writing stuff for the history books as this goes on.
That's right. We all are, actually.
Daniel Howes, always good talking with you. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Usually we do a story when someone decides to run for office. Generally, it isn't much news when a possible candidate decides against a run. But in this case today, it is news. The headline, West Michigan GOP Congressman Justin Amash has decided he will not run for the open U.S. Senate seat in Michigan in 2014. As of now, former Secretary of State Terry Lynn Land is the only declared Republican candidate. Rick Pluta, Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network, joins us now. Rick, how surprising was Amash's announcement?
Well, you know, in some respects, not surprising at all, because Justin Amash really wasn't acting like a statewide candidate. But, you know, Amash is also such an iconoclast that a lot of people were saying that that doesn't necessarily mean that he wouldn't run and sort of, you know, make a play for bigger influence, more prominence for the liberty wing of the Republican Party. In the end, he decided he likes being an influence in the U.S. House of Representatives and a burr under the saddle of the Republican leadership there. So he decided to stick it out in the 3rd Congressional District, where he's likely to win re-election.
So, as I mentioned earlier, as of now, it is only Terry Lynn Land. Should we assume that GOP spot on the ballot is hers for the taking?
You know what? We may not be quite there yet, but boy, it is sure getting close. That Republicans are getting ready for their biennial confab on Mackinac Island, and that's usually the time that you would want to be in by. And there's really no one else out there. Dr. Rob Steele from the Ann Arbor area is supposedly testing the waters, but my understanding is he's going to be waiting for the first round of fundraising reports in October, and he'll see how Terry Lynn Land does before making a final decision. But, you know, right now, she seems pretty close to locking this up.
And for the Democratic side, where do things stand again?
that it's Gary Peters, and Gary Peters, the congressman from the 14th district, is unchallenged for the Democratic nomination. And so that means that if Terry Lindland is, in fact, unopposed as the Republican for the Republican nomination, Gary Peters is unopposed for the Democratic nomination, that the two of them can start going at each other rather than suffering through a divisive, potentially expensive primary that would diminish their prospects next year.
Putting it into perspective, as always, Rick Pluta, Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network. Thanks so much, Rick.
And as always, my pleasure.
All right, Michigan art lovers, it is time. Art Prize open today. And for the next 19 days, downtown Grand Rapids will be crammed with art from all over the world. And we, the public, get to decide which artist is going to win the $200,000 top prize. This is an art show that Time Magazine called one of five festive events you won't want to miss in 2013. And as you might expect, Grand Rapids is buzzing. Michigan Radio's West Michigan reporter Lindsay Smith joins us now from Grand Rapids. Hey, Lindsay.
Hey, Cindy.
So here you are downtown. You've got some 1,800 artists showing some 1,500 works of art all over Grand Rapids. What's downtown like where you are right now?
So I'm in Rosa Parks Circle, and it's, I would say, a pretty typical first day of Art Prize. We've luckily, you know, we've got, this will be the fifth one under our belt, so people know, you know, that live here and work here know better what to expect out of Art Prize. It is definitely busy. There's lots of people with cameras. They get going, and they just get out here right away. Flocks of people, kids in strollers, I see. There's a puppet show going on over here to my right. And then there's still some people that are putting the very, very last finishing touches on some artwork. You're allowed to sort of do that as the event goes on. So there's still some people banging away. I saw some people last night on my way home, too, trying to, in the dark, with flashlights, try to cobble things together that need to get put together. So, yeah, it's definitely getting busy.
What pieces of art, Lindsay, really pop out as someone is coming into Grand Rapids? Did I hear that there's a giant bra?
There is a giant bra, yes. You know, there's always, you know, a few things that get a lot of attention. The giant bra is sort of an obvious one. It's pink. It's got polka dots. It's for... Usually those have some kind of message to go with them, and this one does. If I remember right, it's a breast cancer awareness piece. So, you know, it's sort of fitting.
Yes. What else jumps out? What have you seen so far that makes you go, whoa?
You know, there is another dragon downtown here at the corner. I can see a lot of people are gawking at that. That's pretty cool. There was a dragon there last year, if I remember right. There's also some really cool stuff on the riverfront this year. There's been years where there hasn't been stuff in the river because you have to go through some extra hoops, to be able to put art, install art in the actual river, in the Grand River. So there's some really cool things along the waterfront, a big dome. There's, a lot of stuff on the Blue Bridge that's really catching my eye. But a lot of this stuff I haven't even, you know, it's sort of, I've seen it come together, but, you know, not really anything that's, you know, totally, besides maybe the bra, grabbing my attention immediately. But then again, 1,500 works of art takes a few days to sort of soak up.
It sure does. Lots to uncover. And that gets me wondering, Lindsay, I really believe there are people listening to us who might talk themselves out of going to Grand Rapids for Art Prize because they figure, oh, there's going to be so many people, getting around will be impossible. I'm not going to try it. Is that a true idea, or do you think people can get their arms around Art Prize even if they're newbies?
You can, but I would level your expectations. It's sort of one of those things that, you know, people ask me, oh, I'm coming into town for Art Prize. What should I go see? And my first question is, well, how long do you have? Because it really depends. You know, if you've only got an afternoon, you know, you'll probably stop by some of the, there's these hubs or exhibitors that are, you know, the Grand Rapids Art Museum, the Urban Institute of Contemporary Arts, Grand Valley State University. Those are places where you can go and soak up a lot of works in a short period of time. However, a lot of people also get that idea, so sometimes the lines to get into the Graham are really long. But the good thing is there's art everywhere. I mean, I'm not kidding you. It's like, I compare it to the Ann Arbor Art Fair, except for the Ann Arbor Art Fair, it's like a place downtown. It's blocked off. It's, you know, in a row.
Right.
The thing about art prizes, it's just all over the place. So you really don't, I mean, you can go to lunch and see art prize. You can walk downtown to the next exhibit you're going to go to and you will see art prize. So, you know, I would definitely find a place to park, try to figure out parking ahead of time. There are shuttle buses. That's a great way to get around town. And then there's also the wrap at the bus stations, or the bus lines here have this wristband program where you can, I don't know, like $5 for a wristband and you can ride for 3 weeks. So if you're going to be here for an extended period of time, I mean, that's really the way to go.
Lots of fun, lots of excitement. I know we're going to be there on Saturday meeting Michigan Radio listeners, and I'm excited about that. And it'll be my first art prize.
That'll be fun.
We'll see you then. Thanks so much, Lindsay.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, joining us now is the new executive director of Art Prize. He was formerly with the American Film Institute and the website Internet Movie Database, IMDb.com. Christian Gaines joins us from Grand Rapids. Welcome to Stateside.
Well, thanks for having me.
Christian, you bring such a wealth of experience that you've had working with film festivals. You've worked with Sundance and Cannes, and you've worked with the AFI and the Internet Movie Database. And it struck me that all of that work is about making film accessible and understandable and lifting the audience to a higher level of understanding about film. Is that your vision of what Art Prize could do for art?
Well, I think that that's a great intro. I certainly think that there are parallels that you can draw between the two worlds. Here at Art Prize in Grand Rapids, we're, you know, obviously working with art and artists and audiences and the connections between those things. And I certainly think that you see those kinds of connections in the film festival world as well.
So what drew you personally to say, all right, I'm going to leave the film festival world and I'm coming to this international art competition that is really so unlike anything else?
Well, again, I couldn't agree with you more. I think that's one of the things that really pulled me here is that Art Prize really is unique. There's nothing else really quite like it. And it seems to have accomplished in its short five-year life what I think a lot of other arts and cultural institutions are really kind of looking closely at, which is how to, you know, convert people from sort of passive consumers into passionate advocates for art and artists. And it seems that over the last 5 years, Art Prize has done that. Not by the hundreds or by the thousands, but by the hundreds of thousands of people. This is a phenomenon.
I noticed on your website on artprize.org that there was a notation that many of the 400,000 visitors to Art Prize last year had their very first experience engaging with art right there on the streets of Grand Rapids. And I'm wondering, what do you think they get from being introduced to art in that setting, in downtown Grand Rapids, that's different from walking into a gallery or going to a museum?
Well, you know, I think that art is such a personal experience, and what you get out of it is an ability to be able to look at something, to be able to kind of connect with the personal experience, whatever personal experience you have with that piece of art, and then being able to articulate your feelings about it, even if it's a, you know, if it's a positive or even if it's a negative experience. I sort of feel that it's better to have looked at a piece of art and decided that it's not for you then and articulate that rather than to never have looked at art and to have no opinion at all. So I think that that's the first thing, which is it encourages people that that their opinion is something that counts and that matters. And I think that's the first part of it. I think the second part of it is very much how Art Prize is very much rooted in a sense of place. You know, Art Prize is as much about the pieces that you look at as where they are and the journey of discovery in getting to where they are. So I think that I think one of the things that especially new attendees really look forward to is wandering around the city and exploring and peering around and yielding to the experience and wondering where the art is and is that art and is this art. And I think that whole experience and when you come across a piece of art outside of a museum, say if it's on a bridge or in the river or in a public park, you really think about the decision to put it exactly where it is and why it's there and what's around it. And what that all means.
So it's in my world as opposed to me walking into a gallery and being in that world.
I think that's well put.
Now, the idea, Christian, that all of this is free, what do you think that means to the Image of Art Prize and to the quality of the art that you'll be showing this year?
Well, I think that having free events and having an event that draws people in part because it's free, it can only be a good thing. I think that it's a wonderful thing, not just for the participants, but also for the city of Grand Rapids and actually for the arts community and for the arts and cultural community at large. I also think you can't underestimate sort of the use of technology in Art Prize. So often technology seems to be some sort of an afterthought in the process. And from the very beginning, Art Prize has utilized, has deployed technology through artprize.org or through the smartphone app in kind of an elegant, fluid, and natural way to really encourage engagement among the audience as well as among artists. So, Art Prize is an open competition. It's open to anybody who wants to be an artist. So, our involvement is in making sure that we have a platform, making sure that we introduce rules, but as few of them as possible, to kind of create this sort of level playing field. And what emerges from that platform is really out of our hands. It's really in the hands, ultimately of artists and venues and curators. And then what emerges as the ultimate winner is obviously not in our hands either.
And it's in the hands of the public. And I'm wondering, what's your greatest hope, first, for the tens of thousands of visitors who will be coming to Grand Rapids between now and October 6th?
Mm-hmm. I hope that we're able to kind of blow their mind a little bit. I hope that we get them to kind of think in new ways, to be able to kind of gain new perspectives and sort of see things in a different light. I also hope that it encourages them the ability to be able to articulate with confidence and enthusiasm their opinions around art.
And for those 1,800 artists who are showing their works.
For those 1,800 artists, I want them to think of Art Prize and Grand Rapids as a place where artists are recognized and adored and celebrated and honored for the work that they do. I want them for it to be a crazy, busy, hectic, happy place from the very, very beginning to the very end and hopefully beyond the 19 days of Art Prize. I want them to have exposed their work. I want to honor them for the courage that it takes not just to be an artist, but also to expose your work to strangers. That takes a lot of guts. And that's something that I hope that we can instill in artists, that we honor and respect that idea.
Christian Gaines, the new executive director of Art Prize. The competition opened today and runs through October 6th. You can get all the details on the artist and the competition for that $200,000 top prize and the $100,000 juried prize. You can just go to their website, artprize.org. Christian Gaines, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
It has been an extra magical summer in the small southwest Michigan town of Colon. That's because this summer brought the 77th annual Abbott's Magic Get-Together. It's been put on by the Abbott Magic Company, which has been helping magicians work their wonders since 1934.
Now, what I want you to do is take your favorite image, your favorite color, and put it on top in the box, cap the box up, and give it to me. I'm going to attempt to read your mind.
How did a small Michigan town become, as it likes to say, the magic capital of the world? Well, we find out now as we welcome Greg Bordner. His father co-founded the Abbott Magic Company in January of 1934. Hi, Greg.
Hello.
So Colon's population is what, about 1,200?
Yeah, at most in the summer, yes.
So how did a small Michigan town become so big in the world of magic?
Well, it actually goes back to Harry Blackstone Sr. He was the first real big-time magician to come to town. And he would have other magicians come and help him with his vaudeville show that would go on the road in the winter. And they'd work on making a girl appear out of tires or a botania, a big bouquet of flowers, the vanishing pony, that sort of thing. And So he would bring magicians in from, like, New York City. There's a fellow that's still alive that talks about coming to Tacolin, and he had his spats on and his special hat and vest, and he gets off the bus and all the streets are dirt. And he says, well, what have I done? And then he just loved Colin ever since. But so it was a whole different world back then in 1926. And so magicians were coming to town to just hang out with Harry Blackstone Sr. He had a large piece of property here that's called Blackstone Island. Actually, it's a peninsula. And so he had places for people to stay, a big barn to work on big illusions. And then in the fall, they'd do a little quick opera house here in town. They'd do the dress rehearsal and load everything up on the train and go either east or west, whichever way they were booked.
So it was kind of a place for them to workshop everything, figure it all out, and then hit the road.
That's correct, yes.
Now, really, magic is very central to what Colin's about. Is it true, did I hear right, that the high school mascot is a white rabbit in a top hat?
Yes, we're the magi. Yes, we're the fighting rabbit, yes.
I love it. So clearly this is something that everyone in the town gets behind.
Oh, yes. There's Blackstone Avenue. They named a street after him. There's Illusions Hair Care, Magic City Hardware. It just goes on and on.
Greg Borner, tell us more about the Abbott Magic Company, your company, because it is not every day one encounters a company that's been going since 1934.
Well, that's true. My dad was from Ohio, and he had been interested in magic, tried performing, and he came to town to be with Percy Abbott, who was a touring magician from Australia. And Percy had a magic shop in Australia, and so with my father's backing, they published a catalog of tricks that Percy knew how to manufacture, and they had an open house. That was the first get-together, and so that was kind of the germ of the whole thing getting started here. And then they invented a trick. It was called squash. It's a vanishing shot glass with liquid in it. And it's amazing that a company could be built on a shot glass with liquid in it, as opposed to a lot of times that destroys a company.
That's true.
But we still manufacture squash today and send it all over the world with other magic tricks that we perform or build here. And it's quite the factory.
Greg Borner, owner of the Abbott Magic Shop in Colon. Thanks so much, Greg.
Oh, sure, a pleasure.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A brand new report card has been released from the Bipartisan Commonwealth Fund. The report examines just how well the healthcare systems in each of our 50 states are working, and the conclusion is, if you live in a state that generally performs poorly in healthcare, it doesn't necessarily matter what your income level is. High-income people who live in these poorly performing states are worse off than low-income people who live in states with high health scores. So let's see how Michigan fits into this report card. Joining us now is Kathy Shane. She's a senior vice president at the Commonwealth Fund and the author of the new report. She joins us now from New York City. Welcome to the program, Kathy.
Oh, and thank you so much for inviting me to come on.
Kathy, what were you examining in this report?
We started out focusing on the experiences of low income, and for your listeners, we define that as below 200% of poverty, which, going back to what is that? That is below $40,000 if you're a family, $47,000, or below $23,000 if you're single. So we're not talking about the very poor. We're talking about, in Michigan, it's the bottom 40%, but it is nationally. How did that population fare when we look at access, when we look at quality, when we look at avoidable hospital use, and opportunities to lead healthy and long lives? So four dimensions. And we looked at about 30 different indicators, comparing first the low-income population, and then we looked at, in each state, how did they compare to more affluent people earning 400% of poverty or more, which for a family is above $94,000, so not super rich, but better off. And what we found, and it's the title of the report, is there's just strong evidence that we're often, when it comes to healthcare, two Americas. We're divided by geography and we're divided by income. There's just enormous range of variation, 2 to 5-fold differences between the top state and how low their rates are or good their rates are on preventive care compared to the lagging states across the board. And as you said starting out, surprisingly, sometimes the high-income populations are not doing all that well, and in a few instances, they're doing less well than low-income populations are doing in the top-performing states.
So,
it is a real story of we could do a lot better.
And you certainly proved to us income is not a guarantee of good health care or a long, healthy life in America in 2013.
I think it's not a guarantee, and I would also say low income is not necessarily condemning people to worse health care and worse access. That we see the flip, that there is no reason that income should be a barrier to getting timely preventive care and getting in when you need to, when you're in tooth pain, to a dentist. The major reason and the shared characteristic we can see across states is that if people don't have insurance, whether they're adults or children, they don't get in for timely care. They often put off care, and they end up in the emergency room or with health conditions that get worse when they could have been treated.
I'm speaking with Kathy Shane, who is Senior Vice President at the Commonwealth Fund, and she's the author of a new report entitled Healthcare in the Two Americas, Findings from the Scorecard on State Health System Performance for Low-Income Populations. So let's look at Michigan. Kathy, how did Michigan fare in your report card?
Well, I think the good news for Michigan is you're in the middle. I recently talked to Mississippi and a few of the states that are at the bottom. So Mississippi doesn't do the worst, but it doesn't do the best. It's not often a leader. And where it does, the kind of indicators that are pulling the state down are things such as half of the low-income population, and this again is the bottom 38% of the population in Michigan, so it's a lot of people. Half are either uninsured or poorly insured, meaning they have insurance, but when they get sick, they still spend a lot of their money on health care. That's a very high rate, and it ends up pulling down rates of preventive care, both for older adults and for children, and driving up rates of emergency room. So in many of the statistics for Michigan, as we look across, they're this steady story of about in the middle, sometimes a little bit better, sometimes less well, but not doing well in terms of the numbers. 35% of adults, for example, low-income adults, are uninsured. That's a very high rate. Whether you compare it to the best state rate, which is only 12% are uninsured.
And where is that?
And that's Massachusetts.
Okay.
Massachusetts acted early, as I think some listeners know, and rolled out insurance saying, you know, if you have low income, we're going to help you. It doesn't matter whether you're disabled or not disabled. If income is the story, you're going to need help with a premium. And that started and actually helped spark the move in Congress to say, let's do this for the country. Let's give help to people who have modest or low incomes with both buying insurance and making sure they get a decent policy.
I'm wondering, as I'm sure you know, this whole conversation in Michigan and this debate over expanding Medicaid coverage did end with a just-signed law that will add another 470,000 when all is said and done, another 470,000 more low-income people in Michigan next spring. Will that make a significant difference, do you believe, in the way Michigan's performing in this report card?
Absolutely. States making the decision to join and do Medicaid. In the state of Michigan, that's 20% of the population with under poverty levels of income, means that Michigan will have something on the table for people with very low incomes, under $10,000, under $20,000 a year, also for middle income. Enrollment will be starting in January. People will be starting to show up in October. They'll have till next March on the central marketplaces. We're expecting in all states that do that, that a few years from now, when we look at these numbers again, we're going to see a rising floor and closing of what we now see as this income divide and geographic divide.
Kathy, as we've seen in Michigan, and it's been across the country, so many of the conversations about health care reform smack right up against political differences. You see some Republican lawmakers refusing to vote yes on anything that resembles supporting the Affordable Care Act. Is improvement possible for us as a nation and Michigan as a state? Can we put political differences aside?
I certainly hope we can. You know, if we look back to 1965 when we brought in Medicare, half the elderly were uninsured. And we brought in Medicaid as a state option. All the states ultimately joined. We're talking about health care. This is really not about politics. It's the workforce of every state. Employers need healthy people to show up. Children need to have their dental problems addressed, or they can't learn in school if their mouth is in pain. So it is the health of the population, the health of the workforce. And I think providing people with affordable insurance, just the way when we brought in the drug coverage for the elderly, it wasn't a political event. People just said the elderly, of course they need medication coverage, and we united as a country to do the right thing. And there's a real opportunity to do that here.
And how do you hope policymakers will use the work you've put into this report?
What we're hoping that the people will find this useful in two ways. At the state leadership level, whether it is the leaders of hospital organizations and doctors, or if it's the governor's office and the legislature, they'll be able to look at neighboring states. They'll be able to look at the results for their own high-income population within Michigan and say, where are the gaps? Where should we focus? Let's target on the areas that we're doing relatively poorly, or maybe target on the things that we think are easy to raise the bar, and use it to guide strategic action and to point in a direction. And then over time, be able to say, we hope this is going to look better. Let's take a look 2 or 3 years from now and what we expect to move to know whether we've done a good job.
Kathy Shane is with the Commonwealth Fund. We have put a link to her report, which is entitled Healthcare in the Two Americas, Findings from the Scorecard on State Health System Performance for Low-Income Population. There's a link on our website now at michiganradio.org. And Kathy was kind enough to join us from New York. Thank you so much, Kathy.
Thank you for having me.
This new school year at the University of Michigan has brought some significant change. Earlier this summer, the U of M Board of Regents said yes to offering in-state tuition to undocumented students as long as they meet certain criteria. And all military will be allowed to pay in-state tuition, active, reserved, and honorably discharged. That Board of Regents vote was watched closely by advocates for young people who were brought into this country as undocumented immigrants. Advocates like Serena Davila, she is the executive director for legislative affairs for the Hispanic Association of Colleges and Universities, and she joins us now from Washington. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
Serena, this decision is certainly important in terms of dollars and cents. We should note that out-of-state tuition at U of M is $40,392, and an average in-state student pays $13,142. So triple the difference in terms of money. But what does this mean in terms of a psychological victory or a statement, if you will?
Sure. It's a very strong statement. So as you said, not only financially giving undocumented students more of an access to education, but it also gives students a confidence level that perhaps they didn't have before living in the quote-unquote shadows, that schools and wonderful universities like Michigan are becoming more and more accepting of undocumented students.
What do you see as you work with them day in and day out? What are the biggest hurdles that undocumented students face?
I would say there's still very strong discrimination. I work primarily on Capitol Hill here in Washington, D.C., and not so much with politicians or the staff, but I think just in the way that the American citizens sometimes see and sort of make stereotypes of immigrants. There's still, you know, sort of the thought that perhaps a lot of immigrants are not educated and are here as criminals. They face hurdles. They face hurdles through that discrimination. And also just living, a lot of folks are living with sort of looking over their shoulders a lot of the time. I think policy is changing that, but we still have a long way to go.
Do you find as the national conversation really has grown and it's right there on center stage as far as the challenges of our immigration policy, are Americans changing their views on these young people at all?
I think they are. I think we saw that in the last election with the president being reelected. Primarily, a lot of the news reports reported that women came out in droves, and also the Hispanic vote made a big difference. And I think Republicans and Democrats alike noticed that after the last election, and are sort of paying attention to that for the upcoming election. And we've seen that through the August recess this year, when Congress has been back in their districts. We haven't really seen a lot of protesting that we expected to, in terms of sort of anti-immigrant voices that we've seen, and we take that as a positive sign that people are changing and becoming more accepting, and perhaps realizing that we need to do something about immigration reform.
Serena, what do you believe is the role of universities and colleges in creating change and acceptance for undocumented immigrants, not only in the classroom but beyond into American society?
I think that universities have a sort of responsibility to educate, that is, to understand the laws and the reforms that the government is coming down with, and I think we'll likely see further reforms, hopefully, this year and before the president leaves his term of office. But I think it's the university's responsibility to sort of educate not only the administrators within the university, but also the students, so that they're aware of these changes, and also so that students can learn to work with other students and be more accepting of different backgrounds.
You know, there are people in Michigan, as you know, and across the nation, who strongly believe that if you are not in this country legally with documents, that you don't have the right to the rights and privileges that go along with being a citizen, like in-state tuition. How do you, as you hear these critics, how do you respond to the people who say there are low and even middle class income hopeful students who are not getting any helping hand with their tuition, that they're citizens who should get a break before someone who's an undocumented immigrant?
Right. I understand that argument, and I think, you know, I can see where people are coming from that make that argument. And I think low-income people should receive benefits. You know, we should not forget those people. And this debate is not about taking away, but it's rather giving to as many people as we can. And I would also say that the American dream is based on immigration, and all of us, with the exception of Native Americans, are here as a result of our ancestors becoming immigrants, and somebody in some fashion in the United States helping our ancestors. So it's our obligation to do the same for those coming forward.
The U of M Board of Regents, Serena, agreed to offer the in-state tuition to students if they attended a middle school in Michigan for 2 years and then a Michigan high school for at least 3 years before graduating. Mm-hmm. Now, there are some critics who say that middle school requirement is discriminatory. Do you agree with them?
Yeah, I mean, I can understand. I guess I haven't thought a whole lot about that. I wasn't aware of that provision, but I think that might not be a bad idea, because that simply shows that, you know, people have been in the state. I don't know what the requirements are. I think the requirements should be the same for undocumented as for U.S. citizens. That's how I would answer that.
What is, if you are looking at your hopes, what's your most important national goal in terms of advocating for undocumented students?
I think to be a part of an amazing movement that really impacts and helps undocumented people, not just students, but I think to ultimately pass comprehensive immigration reform, and obviously this wouldn't just be me, but it's a movement of thousands and probably even millions of people across the country, and then also here in Washington, D.C.
And what do you think other colleges and universities around the nation might do, or how might that University of Michigan decision by the Board of Regents, how might that change the way other colleges and universities regard undocumented students?
I think it helps. I think the more and more universities that pass such measures that the University of Michigan did, I think that'll catch on and sort of lead a path for other universities to do so. And I believe that there are 16 states that have that in-state tuition provision in effect. And I think that will only grow the more and more states that are leading the path.
Serena Davila, she's the Executive Director for Legislative Affairs for the Hispanic Association of Colleges and Universities, and she spoke to us today from Washington. Serena, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And as I mentioned earlier in the program, be sure to tune in tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock for a special State of Opportunity call-in show. The discussion will focus on school inequality and funding. And as always, we want to hear from you. Host Jen White will take your calls at 866-255-2762, 866-255-2762. So to be sure to tune in, and you can get more information online at michiganradio.org. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Bob Scon. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Mercedes Mejia, and Katie Suha. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.